This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The United Nations reports that hundreds of thousands of displaced people in northeastern Nigeria, the epicenter of the Boko Haram insurgency, are suffering from high levels of severe malnutrition. Improved security is enabling aid agencies to finally access this area, which previously was cut off by the Islamist insurgents.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Details coming up.
Also in Kenya, six people were killed when two buses were attacked on a highway near the Somali border today. And Burundi's main opposition leader, Agathon Rwasa, says he fears for his life.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour: in Kenya, six people were killed when two buses were attacked on a highway near the Somali border today. Five passengers and a Kenya police reservist were killed in the attack. Witnesses say about 50 Al-Shabaab militants ambushed the buses near the remote town of El Wak. Bus passengers had taken refuge in the buses during the firefight. The armed guards exchanged gunfire with their attackers for about an hour. Kenya Defense Forces arrived an hour later to rescue the passengers. Across the Somali border yesterday, 18 civilians died when their minivan struck a roadside bomb near Lafola, a town south of Mogadishu, the capital. Somali police say all van occupants died when the remote-controlled bomb exploded.
The town of El Wak is one of several remote Kenya towns near the Somali border listed in a travel warning the U.S. Department issued yesterday. The travel advisory is a response to threats by the terrorist group Al-Shabaab. It describes recent Al-Shabaab attacks in Kenya involving shooting attacks by grenades and other explosive devices that have killed and injured residents and travelers. Possible targets include government sites, police stations and vehicles, public transportation, nightclubs and bars, religious institutions, universities, and shopping areas. The advisory says threats of bombings, kidnappings, and attacks on civil aviation continue in Kenya. The warning includes the three counties along the Somali border: Mandera, Wajir, and Garissa, as well as the coastal counties of Tana River and Lamu, an area north of Kilifi, north of Malindi, and the neighborhood of East Leh in the capital city, Nairobi. The advisory also cautions travelers to visit Mombasa's old town only during the day and to avoid using the Likoni ferry across the Kilindini Creek.
Burundi's main opposition leader, Agathon Rwasa, says he fears for his life after getting information that a group of people are after him. He's accusing both the opposition and government as being behind a plot. Moses Havayarimana reports from Bujumbura.
Agathon Rwasa, former rebel and leader of the National Liberation Front, known as FNL in French, he is currently the deputy speaker of the Burundi parliament. Rwasa says that his life is in danger and that opposition forces outside the country and the ruling party CNDD-FDD are planning to kill him. Last year, his wife was injured in an armed attack in a hair salon.
There is no reason for them to kill me. In spite of killing me, if they can't succeed to kill me, they could only provocate another chaos in this country.
You know, we have two groups, I mean, possibly, do you think the opposition or is this from the ruling party?
From both sides.
Agathon Rwasa was the runner-up in the last year's presidential elections, says that some of the opposition in exile are angry that he didn't boycott the polls, but he said it's more likely the ruling party could be plotting against him.
Grabbing their vote, their voters, but I'm not not moving anybody from where he is. I can just meet with people and express my views, that's all. And it's my right, it's the right of any citizen according to the Constitution. Why not for them to make good dispensation, good delivery, where people can be satisfied?
As Mr. Rwasa remains fearful, the authorities say the deputy parliament leader is just playing political game. The government said that Mr. Rwasa chose his own bodyguards and has nothing to worry about. However, the government has denied him access to some provinces. Some say authorities fear he is campaigning for the next elections in 2020.
There are people who are confusing between politics and sectarianism. So there are people who pretend to be in politics, but who are only led by their own selfish interests. They don't think about what can be the interest of the people of Burundi. But personally, I just work for the benefit of the people of Burundi and nothing else than that.
Last year, protests erupted against the incumbent president's move to run for a third term in the office. Most opposition leaders fled the country after one of them, Zed Feruz, was shot dead by unknown armed men. This week, another opposition leader, Charles Nditije, fled to Belgium, raising concerns about his own safety. The international community has continuously called for inclusive dialogue to end the current political crisis, but the government is still reluctant to dialogue with some key opposition leaders whom it accuses of backing a failed coup last year. Moses Habyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
South African journalists are protesting a series of changes at the South African Broadcasting Corporation that they say threaten media freedom. This matter, activists say, because the nation faces important elections in August and people need to hear unbiased news from the public broadcaster. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
No to censorship!
No to censorship! Pansi
or Saudi Pansi!
Pansi!
It was a strange sight. Journalists, who usually cover the news, creating it. South African reporters and editors gathered in Johannesburg and Cape Town on Friday to protest against a series of controversial decisions and events at the South African Broadcasting Corporation. Those include recent edicts to not cover violence and destruction of property during protests, and to not air criticism of the public broadcasting network. At least six journalists have been recently suspended for either disobeying, disagreeing, or liaising with the media without authorization. Earlier this week, the broadcaster's acting chief resigned, saying in his public resignation letter, "What is happening at the SABC is wrong, and I can no longer be a part of it." The SABC has repeatedly denied it is trying to impose censorship. The head of the SABC was not available for comment Friday. The network dominates the nation's airwaves, with 19 radio stations and 4 TV channels. William Byrd, director of Media Monitoring Africa, says today's attempts to limit the news remind him of the dark days of apartheid.
We're seeing self-censorship on the increase. We're seeing threats against journalists internally. We're seeing management actively and openly saying that they don't want journalists to think, they want them to do what they tell them to do. So it's very, very worrying trends, especially as we approach local government elections.
South Africa votes August 3rd. And it is clear that the ruling African National Congress Party sees the SABC as a political battleground. The broadcaster has been previously accused of favoring the ruling party. Last year, the nation's communications minister announced the broadcaster should be seen as a state-owned company and that she should have the right to appoint or suspend its leaders. That debate centered around the figure in the middle of this maelstrom, SABC Chief Operating Officer Claudie Motsoeneng. Motsoeneng, who earned criticism for proposing that all journalists be licensed and that SABC journalists wear uniforms, landed in hot water when the nation's anti-corruption czar discovered that he had lied about having a matric certificate, which is equivalent to an American high school diploma. Protesters are calling for Motsoeneng to resign. Dashan Moodley is the host of Midday Live on SAFM Radio. On Friday, as protesters were gathering before his show started, he did what any journalist would do. He followed the news. After the show, he talked with VOA News and explained that he was just doing his job.
There were concerns from my staff members, my producers who work on my show, that this would be a story that would bring us unwanted criticism from within the company. But again, we're journalists and, you know, criticism, you know, come hell or high water, we cover stories.
It was, Mudley says, a no-brainer. Tell it like it is so people can decide for themselves. Otherwise, he said, what's the point of journalism? Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
A new study finds that cash transfers rather than food rations have greater impact on refugees living in Rwanda. The study was conducted by the UN's World Food Program and the University of California. It measured the local community impact of food assistance provided by the WFP to Congolese refugees living in three camps in Rwanda. Steve Taravella is the acting deputy director for the WFP in Washington. He spoke with me about the significance of the findings and what it means for future humanitarian assistance.
Increasingly, humanitarian agencies are trying to demonstrate that our work is based in evidence, that we're not developing programs based on instinct or perceived need, but on actual need, and that we can use donor funds more wisely that way. So in this case, the big takeaway for us is that when humanitarian agencies that are delivering food, like the UN World Food Program, provide that assistance through cash mechanisms that enable beneficiaries to purchase their own food rather than us giving them actual food, the benefits go far beyond the way we improve the life of that individual or that family, but in fact affect the larger community in very positive ways. And for us in the UN, that's a really important finding because our work is all about strengthening communities. We want communities to be more resilient to all sorts of shocks, so to speak. The fact that there's increasing evidence, and this study from UC Davis and the International Food Policy Research Institute really adds a lot to that discussion.
How was the study performed and who was involved?
The University of California at Davis, the International Food Policy Research Institute, and the World Food Program collaborated on this study in three camps in Rwanda where Congolese refugees are living and receiving food assistance. And they used very scientific data analysis methods to look closely at the way food assistance was delivered, on the impact that it had on camps where food was delivered via cash mechanisms, which might not be actual cash. It could be e-cards, it could be vouchers, it could be money loaded onto cell phones, but a cash mechanism versus camps where Congolese refugees in Rwanda received actual food. Interviews were conducted also with vendors and members of the community to assess if, in fact, there was a real difference in impact. The researchers found that there was a significantly greater positive impact on the broader community, even those living outside the refugee camps, where food assistance was delivered by a cash mechanism rather than the actual delivery of food.
What are some examples of the economic impact regarding the benefits of the cash for refugees?
Well, I guess maybe the most persuasive is that, you know, we say that for every dollar's worth of food for refugees, it increases real income for the community by about $1.20 U.S. But in two of these three refugee camps where refugees were receiving cash transfers each month instead of in-kind food, each dollar they received translated into ranging from $1.51 to $1.95 in the local economy. Well, that's almost double. That's really significant. It improves the lives of those in the community, of those doing business with the community, and certainly of those in the refugee camps who are our primary aim.
Going forth, then, how will these findings change the way you all do humanitarian assistance for refugees?
That's a good question. Increasingly, we are delivering food assistance where possible using these cash mechanisms. And this study confirms that we're on the right track in doing that. This year, WFP hopes to reach about 9.5 million people in 54 countries with almost $1 billion in transfer value of food assistance. That would be up from last year where we transferred about $680 million in food assistance via cash. So we are moving in that direction. It is a significant part of our work. That said, I want to be clear for your audience that cash assistance for food isn't always the best answer. We still deliver in many settings actual food because many settings food isn't available in local markets, for instance, or emergency conditions don't enable us to provide cash assistance. So we assess every situation differently and decide what's the most efficient, the best for those people who are in need, the easiest for them to get food, and the most cost effective. And right now, in those settings where we've determined that cash is the most useful, it's just really reassuring to have scientific studies like this showing that that's in fact the case.
Steve Taravella is the acting deputy director of the WFP. He spoke with me from Washington.
Past the hour, you are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The United Nations reports that hundreds of thousands of displaced people in northeastern Nigeria, the epicenter of the Boko Haram insurgency, are suffering from high levels of severe malnutrition. Improved security is enabling aid agencies to finally access this area, which previously was cut off by the Islamist insurgents. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Much of Borno State in northeastern Nigeria was off limits to aid agencies after Boko Haram gained control of large swathes of the territory in mid-2014. The Nigerian army and regional forces have now chased the insurgents out of most towns and cities, and Boko Haram controls only four of Borno State's 27 local government areas. The spokesman for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Jens Lajerke, says returning aid workers describe scenes of destruction and people living under shocking conditions. He says people are extremely short of food and more than 500,000 people require immediate food assistance.
These are mainly subsistence farmers who live there. If they are displaced from their land, they cannot produce the food that they are supposed to eat. So that is of major concern. The security is not ideal, absolutely not. It's still early days for this opening up of these areas.
Lajerke says the Nigerian government and humanitarian organizations are stepping up aid, but he says the situation in this area is so critical that a much faster and wider response is required. He says the humanitarian operation is severely underfunded.
A couple of days ago, the emergency relief coordinator released some $13 million to that particular response that is a kickstarter, if you like, hoping very much and urging other donors to follow suit.
Lajerke says the emergency injection of money will provide immediate life-saving food, nutrition, and protection assistance to 250,000 people. But he notes a much larger sum of money, $203 million, is urgently needed to assist the many desperate victims that Boko Haram has created. Since the insurgency began in 2009, violence in northeastern Nigeria has displaced some 2.4 million people from their homes. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A new documentary, Journey into Europe, explores the place of Islam in European history and civilization. The film was shot across the continent in countries such as Germany, the UK, France, Spain, and Bosnia. It reflected the status of Muslim immigrants to Europe. The producer of the documentary is Ambassador Akbar Ahmed, Chair of Islamic Studies at the American University in Washington. Our senior Middle East reporter, Mohammed El-Shanawi, asked Professor Akbar about challenges facing Muslim immigrants in Europe today.
We traveled not only to Eastern Europe and Southern Europe, we went to Africa. We traveled to Melilla, which is a part of Spain but still on the African continent. And in Sicily, in Italy, we interviewed several African immigrants. One of them in particular, who's in the film, Emadu, is a 16-year-old boy from the Gambia who had traveled across the Sahara. Took him over a year to travel and turned up in Sicily, which is where we met him. It's a very powerful, very moving story, and I hope that story helps explain the story and the predicament and the the reason why so many Africans are leaving home to try to come to Europe and try to earn some living so they can then in turn help people back home, where you have all kinds of problems, both political, economic, and even social.
How would you compare challenges facing Muslims coming from Africa into Europe compared to Arab Muslims?
It's a very interesting question. The Arabs coming to Europe are coming for directly political reasons. The vast majority of Syrians arriving in Europe are coming because of the civil war taking place in Syria. So they're escaping a situation. They're seeking shelter. They're not primarily coming to Europe. Millions are going to Turkey and Jordan and Lebanon, but a lot of them are also coming to Europe. The Africans are coming for a very different reason. They're coming primarily to escape economic poverty and political chaos at home. So they're coming hoping to establish themselves, earn some money, and eventually go back or send the money back home so that their families can live a better life. So two very different reasons. In Europe, of course, people see immigrants in one category. They see them all as immigrants. And the patience of a lot of Europeans have been very, very generous, like the Greeks or the Italians, who do not have a particularly healthy economy at this stage. You know, there's high unemployment, economic crisis. They themselves are having problems. In spite of that, so many local people have gone out of their way to help immigrants, just simply help them, because they've said, like the mayor of Palermo in Sicily, he says to us, no man is illegal. Every man is legal. He comes here, we must welcome him, because that is the Sicilian tradition. And he's very proud. He says, we have an Arab Islamic presence in Sicily. We're very proud of this culture. So you see, these things we don't know, because these influences form Europe and European culture and how Europeans think of themselves. The right-wing parties in Europe, and now many mainstream Europeans, have two complaints about the Muslims. They say Muslims are not part of Europe, and they say Muslims have not contributed anything to European civilization. Now, my film and my book disprove both points. Muslims have contributed very, very heavily to European culture and civilization. And Muslims have been part of European society and culture for over 1,000 years. People forget that Muslims first came to Europe in 711, in the 8th century, and gave Europe one of its greatest civilizations in Andalusia. Andalusia, with its head capital in Cordoba, was once the most glittering city of all of Europe. People forget this, and it was a Muslim kingdom. People forget that Cordoba, the capital of Andalusia, had a library, the main library, with 600,000 manuscripts, when the largest library in Europe had 600. So Muslim culture encouraged learning, compassion, inclusivity, not all the time, but there were times of great harmony between Jews, Christians and Muslims. Now, those are things that are not very well known in Europe. And unfortunately, even Muslims seem to have forgotten what they once contributed to Europe, because had they remembered that lesson, they may not have then been so keen to inflict violence on Europeans as they are doing today in some cases. And we need to revive the memory of a time when Muslims, Christians and Jews could live together, work together and create together. So that's one of the great lessons I hope that people will take from the book and the film.
That was Ambassador Akbar Ahmed, Chair of Islamic Studies at the American University in Washington. He was speaking with reporter Mohammed El-Shanawi.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. VOA. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.